Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Black and white.
Lo poderoso del mundo, el occidente.
The powerful countries of the world, the arrogant Western ones, today are in crisis. The crisis comes fundamentally because their neocolonial system could not be supported permanently, neither by the countries nor by the nations.
Permanente, ni por los países ni por los pueblos. Hoy día,
today, what is said to be related, for example, to the G7, which is the group of the powerful countries, is already behind BRICS.
Punto y medio más atrás que los BRICS.
BRICS have 31.5% of the world GDP. Meanwhile, the G7 has only 30% of the world GDP. Either way, countries are already trading in their own currencies. Trade between China and Russia is 70% in rubles and yuan. Oil trade between Russia and India is in rupee. President Lula, who has recently been to China, has publicly argued that the global South should trade in its own currency to replace the dollar. The dollar is the essence of American domination. Clearly, today it is in decline. And nations, by the way, are looking for their sovereignty and their independence. It is an important fact to take into account when understanding the world and understanding the processes that are coming forward. Along with the profound economic changes that are taking place, there are also changes of a military nature. The technology, the military advancement of Iran and the Republic of China and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea are immense. And this speaks of the fact that the independent sovereign countries and peoples are willing to confront the imperialist Western powers that intend to continue with the neocolonial system in any field. The dollar is the measure that it is falling, that each time the world reserves are smaller. In 2001, we had 73% of the reserves in dollars. In 2021, we had 55% of reserves, and in 2022, 47% of world reserves were in dollars. It is obviously falling. This is very important when it comes to confronting the blackmail, the blockade, and the pressures of imperialism and its Western European allies to subdue nations and prevent them from having their own policy of independence and sovereignty. That is essential. But there's one more chapter missing, which is the path to independence all countries must follow. Yes, of course, BRICS is an excellent idea. But what about the small countries? We must take advantage of this opportunity to mark our own path of independence in this decline of North American imperialism, in this fall of North American imperialism, and prepare ourselves to have sovereignty, independence, and social justice, which is the centenary claim of our nations and countries. Today, the world is heading towards a new historical moment. We can already say that we are fully in a multipolar world, in a world that is simply placing sovereignty, independence, and justice at the center, and where the dollar is clearly not the one that rules. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Estamos con Renato Vélez Castro.
We are with Renato Vélez, who has a degree in history and a master's degree in international studies from the University of Chile in the Black and White program on Hispan TV. Welcome.
Thank you, Eduardo, for your invitation.
As we have a little time, let's immediately start our talk. Look, at the end of the last century, it seemed that the world could no longer advance in social and economic points of view. There was a triumphalism of a unipolar world that gave the orders and directed the entire international field. However, today we're witnessing a disintegration of this unipolar world, and we're at the emergence of a multipolar world. What role does BRICS play in this new age, in your opinion?
Renato, según tu opinión.
Bueno, mira, hay que contextualizar.
It is necessary to contextualize a bit, because something interesting is that sometimes there is talk of transition from a unipolar order to a multipolar order. But the reality that we lived through was a transition from a bipolar world that was from the Cold War to a multipolar world in terms of order. Because unipolarity was a moment when only one superpower could dominate the entire world due to its economic, military, financial, ideological superiority, etc. That was also a mirage, a fantasy, exactly. So if one looks at documents of North American thinkers from the 1990s, he realizes that the unipolar moment in force was in the 1990s, during the Gulf War period, when George H.W. Bush announced the New World Order. And there's a very interesting document from the Pentagon at this time that is a defense planning document. In this document, it is said that the mission of the United States is to make sure that a new superpower does not emerge in Asia, in the former Soviet Union territories, and in Western Europe. And this is very interesting because, well, when it talks about Asia, logically, it is talking of China. When it mentions the former Soviet Union, it is talking about Russia. And when it mentions Western Europe, it means the U.S. is afraid of emergence of a self-reliant France or Germany. A France that at some point with Charles de Gaulle was against NATO, and he took France out of the NATO command, squared off with the Arab countries in a 1967 war. Then he was a somewhat dissonant actor there, and they tried hard to get rid of him. So something interesting that happens in the 90s is precisely the role of NATO. NATO as an umbrella that ensures U.S. supremacy over Western Europe, and logically, NATO should have been over after the disappearance of the Soviet Union, but it continued to exist. Then it is in the 90s that the war in Yugoslavia takes place, and this war justifies the invasion and aggression of NATO, first in the context of Balkan War, and then in the Kosovo War, and this justifies that NATO continues to exist, this subordination of Europe to the U.S. So this is very important. This was the unipolar moment, because when we have, starting in 2001, an attempt by the arrogance of the superpowers of the empires to take this to the limit, when George W. Bush invaded Afghanistan and then Iraq, but the same one also generates a maximum expansion that the domination of power of the United States can have. The Americans set the full spectrum domain. This means aerospace, maritime, terrestrial, outer space, cyberspace. They thought of a planetary domain, but their attempt failed. Because deep down, the United States was not capable of achieving its objectives in Iraq, partly because of the role that Iran played in Iraqi resistance against the U.S. occupation, but also for something else. At the end of the 1990s, the U.S. had an attempt to subordinate Russia to the umbrella of the West, and in this sense, Boris Yeltsin played a collaborationist role. But later, Putin came to power. It turns out that Putin, initially, when the war in Afghanistan takes place, he intends to collaborate with NATO.
And even Putin asks to join the European Union.
Well, of course, he centers the European Union in NATO. Putin says that we have a common enemy, which is the Taliban in Afghanistan, that we fought these people in the 80s, and they are common enemies, also the terrorism that existed in Chechnya. So Putin says, good, because if NATO is not supposed to be against anyone, why won't they let us join NATO so that we can dispel this fear? This does not happen at the end of the day, and this idea is being confirmed that deep down, NATO is an instrument to bring Russia closer, not only because NATO is expanding to include more countries, but also because governments that were close to Russia are overthrown in the color revolutions. They occupy civil society to destabilize these governments and then leave the area, and this is the limit. And then two things happen. The failure of the U.S. in Iraq and this geopolitical option that Russia is taking, that in reality the Russians say that they would like to accommodate themselves in this unipolar order, but they didn't allow us to do so.
But there was no opportunity for Russia to exist from the capitalist point of view. They wanted to disintegrate Russia precisely. Well, we're going to take a break now. But we will continue in the second half of the program here with Renata. We are with Renato Velez. What you raised in the first part about the role of BRICS and how it accelerated the disintegration of this unipolar world remained pending. I agree with your explanation about this case. It existed for a very short time, and it was more like a fantasy, or it was a wish of the West and North American imperialism for the rest of the world. But since things do not start from desire and have a material reality, like BRICS, today they are emerging with so much strength. Are these countries in BRICS playing such an important role?
Look, it is very paradoxical that the concept started as BRIC, that included Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And this was a concept coined by the Goldman Sachs Bank, which is one of the great institutions of international financial capitalism. But deep down, the BRICS countries, fundamentally Brazil, in the Lula era, China, on the other hand, Russia took seriously what the enemy was proposing, and they began to form and carry out BRICS summits. At the BRICS summits, the need for a multipolar international order began to be raised for each great region of the world, where each great power plays the role of arbitrator in an equal position. A reform to the international financial architecture is beginning to be proposed, and de-dollarization was raised as the least an idea of more than 10 or 15 years ago.
How do the existence and strengthening of BRICS and the bank that BRICS has, which is known as the World Development Bank, affect the role of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank?
Of course, something interesting is that many of these financial initiatives were driven by China, even without the existence of the BRICS World Development Bank. And this is seen a lot in Africa. For example, one of the countries with the greatest promoters of the African Union as an organization with financial support in China. China built the headquarters of the African Union in Ethiopia. China financed projects of the African Union, has canceled debts in a summit in Moscow 3 weeks ago where they lowered 30 African countries' debts and made a pardon. In this sense, there is something very interesting. The Chinese are looking for what they call win-win development. China also has this concept of a shared future, a diverse humanity in its political forms that has roots in its historical tradition. But in the face of common problems, China calls for collaboration and not the imposition of political models.
From a political point of view, the Chinese say that we don't get involved, but if we apply this win-win policy.
And the very interesting part of win-win is that they already have some very traumatic results. I believe that in this sense, since the war in Ukraine was an accelerating point, the majority of the world did not join the Western scheme of supporting the Ukrainian side in the conflict. But also, in the other hand, they say that if the Westerners already have a party in this conflict, we, who are not being part of this conflict, have to look for other arbitrators. And there is a negotiation between Saudi Arabia and Iran that China mediated, and that's an important event.
Pay attention to this point, that this meant putting an end to, or at least reaching an agreement to put an end to, that cruel, terrible war that existed in Yemen.
Exactly, but look at this detail. When the United States is a mediator in Middle Eastern affairs, the war is accentuated, but they always coordinate it with the Israeli regime. If Israel does not agree with what it is negotiating, it will not be done. And this was the first major negotiation in the Middle East where the Israelis did not find out what they were discussing. China surprised the world in this case with this negotiation between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Today, we see a commander of the Saudi Arabian military telling Iranian commanders that they can come to his country and take the pilgrimage. It is very radical and a very fast change that we also see in other aspects, as we mentioned before, de-dollarization, which existed as an idea for more than 10 or 15 years, but in the last few weeks, it's advanced significantly.
President Lula has argued that the global south has to negotiate with its own currencies.
Exactamente.
Yeah, exactly. The de-dollarization process is inevitable. Even countries like Saudi Arabia are strategically and historically aligned with the United States and are trading oil in yuans, in the Chinese currency, and also in rubles with Russia.
Now, how are the smaller countries doing? There is a number of countries that have asked to join BRICS, and it is increasing. They say it is the new trend to join BRICS. In this case, small countries are left to have their own possibility of sovereignty and independence. The policies of large countries in BRICS open a space and are considered as a step forward without a doubt. But in what way can this help the process of sovereignty, independence, and social justice in the rest of Asia, Africa, and especially in Latin America that includes small countries? This actually excludes larger countries like Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico.
The existence of BRICS and the existence of a multipolar world is not the solution to these problems, but it opens a gigantic window of opportunities. This is very important because basically this also depends on the will of the political leadership of these countries, of the people of these countries, to take a different path. Because multipolarity does not represent any benefit to the nations. Rather, it is what the countries do with this reordering of the international system. For example, the experience of Greece is very interesting. Greece suffered a very deep financial crisis in 2008. They privatized practically all the public infrastructure, among other things, the ports. So it turns out that a Chinese state company bought the port of Piraeus, which is the port of Athens, in the conditions that were offered in the sale, that is, with subcontracting for the workers, with most of the profits going to foreign capital, that is China, and not for the Greek state, with a series of conditions. Obviously, if you're being offered something, that they're not going to take it away. So what happened? The Syriza government arrived with the finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis.
This is a self-proclaimed and progressive and left-wing government.
But here comes the interesting thing. This government said that it wants to renegotiate the Piraeus Agreement with China, and Varoufakis told the Chinese company that he wanted Chinese to continue to have ownership of the people. But 51% of the profits go to the Greek state, not a minority, but the majority, and that there is no more subcontracting, and all workers are unionized. And what did the Chinese say? Yes, there isn't a problem, because they will continue to benefit the same. What do I mean by this is that the fundamental thing is the decision made by the political leadership of the countries. Here is a discussion of lithium, and there has been a lot of discussion about creating this national lithium company to absorb foreign capital. But the question is to do what? And this is the decision that the Chilean authorities, the state and government, and the Chilean people have to make.
El Estado chileno, el gobierno y el pueblo chileno.
Ahí está el rol entonces de los pueblos.
There's then the role of the nations, the type of leaders they have, the character of the states, whether they are independent and sovereign or if they are simply an element.
O simplemente son una factoría.
Exactly. There's a fundamental problem here in Chile that I have heard from another Indian intellectual, that the problem the Chilean leadership fears is that it continues to see the world with the eyes of the 90s.
But Chile lives in this world, and it seems that nothing has changed in this country. Perhaps in other Latin American countries, this vision is also quite strong. Who runs the big media?
Obviously, but this is worrying in our case because even countries like Argentina are seeing the world in a different way. In fact, 2 or 3 years ago, Argentina announced that they're going to start trading with yuans, not dollars.
Yeah, it is intolerable for the U.S. because, for example, the North American Senator Marco Rubio has said that what Lula is doing is outrageous, and what Argentina can do is also the same. Because it clearly means that if they are not with us, they are against the dollar. They are simply opening a space that will leave us with our hands tied to take sanctions. How can they sanction without a dollar? As you see, this issue of sanctions at this time, that there are 30-odd countries with sanctions, and now they're coming back because they have not been able to do anything to Russia.
That's right. Large countries with resilience capacities can circumvent the sanctions, and in the end, the North Americans are causing their own failure because they hit half of the world with their sanctions, and all these countries from a parallel financial, economic, political system, and also in terms of security. We saw military exercises by China, Russia, and South Africa in the Atlantic Ocean. This is extraordinary. So in the end, this same imperial arrogance that the United States has is causing its own international isolation. Even Emmanuel Macron said that France has to stop depending on the dollar.
Macron,
and we will finish our program with this point. Macron has said that the issue of Taiwan with China is far from France and has said the same thing about a scandal that is happening nowadays in the U.S.
Precisely, because France has no interest in this conflict. In addition, the U.S. makes a parallel alliance with Australia, Japan, South Korea to knock China, and this caused Australia to cancel a contract with France on nuclear submarines. Neither does France have much interest in joining this scheme.
Thank you very much, Renato, for being here in Black and White. Thank you very much.
Ah! This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
China has repeatedly warned against the establishment of an Asia-Pacific version of NATO, making it clear its opposition to any foreign military involvement in the region. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Daily News Hungary has covered this story and tells us more. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has sounded the alarm bell about an inevitable war to take place between Washington and Beijing, as the United States is reluctant to accept China's supremacy. The Daily cited Viktor Orbán as speaking at a venue in Transylvania, Romania, on Saturday, 22nd of July. Orbán said, "The United States does not accept the fact that China has overtaken it in many sectors of industry." He added, "The United States does not accept the fact that it has become the world's second most powerful nation after China." The outspoken Hungarian Prime Minister said China was in a deep slumber for hundreds of years, but woke up and managed to develop as much in 30 years as other countries have done in the past 200 years. Viktor Orbán said, due to development and technological advancements, the Chinese nation now claims its place under the sun. He added, however, Washington does not accept such quick development. As a result, a clash between the two world powers is inevitable. Tensions between the United States and China have significantly escalated, particularly over the issue of Taiwan and the South China Sea. Despite publicly recognizing China's sovereignty over Taiwan under the One China policy, the United States continues to remain the island's most important international supporter and supplier of arms, a source of constant tension between Washington and Beijing. The United States has created the Quad Partnership with India, Japan, and Australia, in addition to the AUKUS Alliance, also with Australia, alongside the United Kingdom. Both U.S. PACs are intended to strengthen the ability of each government to support security and defense interests in the form of a military NATO-like alliance. China has repeatedly warned the United States against the expansionist foreign policy. Earlier this month, Beijing opposed NATO's eastward expansion, viewing it as a threat by the U.S.-led NATO military alliance to further intrude into the Asia-Pacific region. China has vowed to firmly respond to any threat against its legitimate rights in the Asia-Pacific. The warning came in a statement issued by China's mission to the European Union following a NATO summit in the Lithuanian capital Vilnius on 12th of July, where the US-led Western military alliance lashed out at Beijing, accusing China of challenging NATO members' interests, security and values. In response, Beijing asserted the Chinese government will firmly defend its national sovereignty, security and interests against any threats from the United States. The India Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. The United States and Australia rehearsed precision missile strikes during war games on Saturday, 22nd of July, the latest in a series of moves by the partners amid growing tensions with China in the Indo-Pacific region. The live fire drills were held at the Shoalwater Bay military complex in the northeastern region of Queensland as part of a two-week-long Talisman Sabre joint military exercises. It comes as Canberra overhauls its military strategy, focusing on long-range firepower in a bid to purportedly keep the potential adversaries at arm's length. Major Jimmy Sheehan, Talisman Sabre spokesperson for United States Forces, said, "These initiatives and firsts ultimately create an exercise that will enhance Australia and America's ability to respond to global security challenges in this region." The U.S. Secretary of Navy, Carlos Del Toro, claimed at the start of the exercises on Friday, 21st of July, that the most important message that China can take from this exercise and anything that our allies and partners do together is that we are extremely tied by the core values that exist amongst our many nations. Meanwhile, Lieutenant General Greg Bilton, Australia's Chief of Joint Operations, claimed that a Chinese spy ship has been sighted off the northeastern coast of Australia while preparations for the military exercises were underway. On Saturday, 22nd of July, the US commissioned the Independent Class Littoral Combat Ship, named USS Canberra, at a ceremony at an Australian naval base in Sydney Harbour, officially joining the US Navy's active fleet. China has repeatedly warned against the establishment of an Asia-Pacific version of NATO and made clear its opposition to any foreign military involvement in the region. The warning came in response to a communique made at a NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania on 12th of July, alleging that China's hybrid and cyber operations and its confrontational rhetoric and disinformation target allies and harm alliance security. China said the NATO communique distorts China's position and policies, adding that the Western military alliance's activities will inevitably undermine regional peace and stability. China's Global Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. China and Russia have begun joint naval and air drills in the Sea of Japan, aimed at strengthening cooperation between the two countries' navies and maintaining peace and stability in the Asia-Pacific region. Russia's Defense Ministry said in a statement on Thursday, 20th of July, that the four-day joint military exercises, dubbed Northern Interaction 2023, will be held from 20th to 23rd of July as scheduled, in accordance with the International Military Cooperation Plan. The statement said the two countries' naval forces will practice conducting joint anti-submarine warfare and naval combat maneuvers. It added they will carry out sea and air convoys of ships, protect and defend groups of ships when moored in an unprotected estuary, and ensure the security of communications in the waters and airspace of the Sea of Japan. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, joint artillery firing is also planned during the Russia-Chinese military exercises. The latest drills come as the two countries have pledged to deepen their military cooperation. China and Russia have agreed to expand trade, energy and political relations amid the West's increasingly adversarial approach over the war in Ukraine. Washington has become more vigilant about relations between Beijing and Moscow ever since Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin struck a new limits partnership back in February of 2022. China has blamed the United States and NATO for provoking Moscow over the Ukraine war and has condemned Western sanctions against Russia. Russia has also strongly backed China amid the recent tensions between Beijing and Washington over the U.S. political and military interference in Taiwan. The United States claims Washington's anti-Beijing measures aim to protect U.S. interests. During her recent visit to China, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen confirmed that the two sides will continue to have disagreements in this regard. Janet Yellen said, "The United States will, in certain circumstances, need to pursue targeted action to protect its national security. And we may disagree in these instances." Among the measures targeting Chinese firms, the U.S. back in October announced sweeping export controls that restrict the ability of Chinese businesses to develop advanced semiconductors. Also recently, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Beijing. Blinken's visit came after China's top military officials continued to refuse to hold talks with their American counterparts in recent months, citing U.S. sanctions imposed against Beijing and senior Chinese officials as an obstacle to maintaining cordial relations between Beijing and Washington.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio and the program Islamic Laws, in which we are going to talk about the rules and fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei, which are related to the month of Muharram and mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Before everything, let me express my condolences to the Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance and all the Muslims all around the world, especially the Shias, on this being the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Like always, we are joined by our dear guest, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, salamu alaikum, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Salamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
So as I mentioned, today we will answer to the questions asked from the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, but before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Welcome back. You are listening to Islamic Laws from IRIB English Radio. Sheikh Javid, today's first question is about mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and also saying the prayer on time or in the early portion of the time. Let me give you an example. For example, on the day of Ashura, people are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before the noon adhan or noon call for prayer. Or on the night before Ashura, they are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before adhan al-Maghrib, before, at the time in the afternoon and before the sunset. And then they hear the call for prayer, for noon prayer in the day of Ashura or the night prayer on the night before Ashura. Now, the question is that, which is more important? The congregational prayer offered in the early portion of the time or continuing with azadari and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? And I think it happens a lot. I mean, this is a question for many Muslims, mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, especially the Shia. As I mentioned, the best example is the 2 days of Tasu'a and Ashura, the 9th and 10th of Muharram, because from early morning, people are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and then they hear the call for Zuhr prayer. Or we can think of the night, every night of Muharram, some people begin mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before sunset, and then they hear the call for Maghrib prayer. Now, the question is that, which one is better, to continue with azadari or stop that and say the prayer on time?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, of course, we do know that congregational prayer is a prayer which is offered in congregation. It's a wajib prayer offered in congregation. And
Salat is... obligatory, congregational prayer is recommended.
Yeah, the prayer itself is wajib, but the congregational prayer is recommended. And of course, generally speaking, praying or offering prayer on time is more important, and precedence should be given to offering prayer on time. Now, to compare congregational prayer with azadari, of course, the religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, are of the view that we should give importance and precedence to offering congregational prayer on time, you see, because it's wajib, it is obligatory, mm-hmm. and we have to give importance to an obligatory act rather than a recommended act. Azadari is not wajib. No one considers azadari or mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam to be obligatory, but it is highly recommended, of course. So, as you rightly mentioned, this is one of the frequently asked questions, and of course, such incident does take place in different countries. Especially, I believe this event takes place a lot in the Indian subcontinent, because as far as I know, such coincidence takes place. The congregational prayer goes on, and at the same time, an azadari or a majlis is expected to be held. Now, which one to be given more importance? Obviously, the congregational prayer has to be offered first, and then, of course, the azadari should be continued. And if it is difficult to stop, of course, mu'minin can continue with their azadari, because, for example, if azadari is already going on, and if you stop it, the whole ceremony, of course, will come to an end.
They need to, arrange it in a way.
The arrangement has to be important. In such a way that the azadari should not take place at the time of the wajib prayer. It has to come after it.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you, who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces, who are you?
And I believe that it is shown by Imam Hussein alayhi salam himself on the day of Ashura.
You're right.
When one of his companions told him that this is the time for Zuhr prayer, and the Imam prayed for him, and Imam Hussein alayhi salam stopped continuing the war, and he began saying the prayer. And what is important is that Imam lost some of his companions during that prayer.
So it
shows the importance of that prayer.
You're right.
And alhamdulillah, we see that recently in these years, at least on the day of Ashura, we see that alhamdulillah, all the mu'mineen, they, as you mentioned, arranged in on their azadari in a way that it finishes at the time of noon prayer. They say the congregational prayer, and then they continue mourning for Imam al-Hasan.
Right.
Now, on the same note, Sheikh Jawid, some may ask that we see that some people, again, maybe especially the youth, they like to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam even late at night. And it causes some of them, because they sleep very late at night, then it they are sure that it will cause them somehow to lose morning prayer, if we may
put it
this way. And they are not able to wake up early in the morning, and it becomes qaza. So is it something, religiously speaking, encouraged for the youth to do that?
Well, it's absolutely forbidden to miss one's prayer. In the example that you gave, especially the young generation, the teenagers, who have attained puberty, they continue with azadari until late midnight, and then in the morning some of them miss their prayers. That's an unfortunate thing. You know, it's not permissible to let your prayer be lapsed or to be missed. You know, it's very essential to offer your prayers and not to miss them. And also in this time around, you know, everybody has a mobile phone, everybody has access to an alarm clock which
true.
They can wind up and then so that the clock might ring him up and he can offer his prayers. So it's basically very important for every individual to understand the importance of prayer. the importance of fulfilling this duty and offering this fulfilling this obligation. Prayer is the most important pillar, and of course, if prayer is not accepted, if prayer is not valid, then all other acts of worship will be affected. So if it's rejected, just as there's a saying from Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, and also Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, if prayer is rejected, all other acts of worship, such as fasting, such as azadari, and the likes of such things, will be rejected as well.
At the end of the day, we are talking about an obligatory action like prayer and salat,
yes,
and a recommended action that is mourning for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So as you rightly mentioned, the preference should be given to the prayer. And I believe that, first of all, it is the duty of the scholars, especially those who have lectures during the month of Muharram, to explain this fact for the youth who are, I mean, their intention is very good because they are going to show their love for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and they mourn for him. They love to mourn late at night. But this very important point should be, I believe, mentioned by the great Shia scholars, that they can have both, to mourn for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and not to lose the obligatory prayer.
Yes, yes.
And second of all, it's the duty of those, again, who arrange these ceremonies. They can arrange it in a way that, because you see that people like to mourn for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam like 1 hour, 2 hours, so they can start the program earlier so that they can mourn and have enough time to sleep also during the night and wake up for the following day.
You're right.
Sheikh Javid, unfortunately, we are running out of time. Again, I would like to thank you for your presence in this program. And again, I would like to express my condolences for these sad days of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Inshallah, we'll continue answering these questions in the following session. Till then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour, one more Palestinian is killed in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, where three others lost their lives.